You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers signed a bill last week guaranteeing public access to most body camera footage. The law doesn't require police to use body cameras, but it does declare that any footage is generally available to the public under open records law. Do you support or oppose the use of police body cameras? What about the new law governing how long the footage is kept? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Help us understand the new law. What does it do?
Well, it went into effect March 1st. As you mentioned, Governor Evers signed it into law last week. It provides uniform regulations and guidelines related to the use, storage, and maintenance of body cameras and the data or the video that they collect. More specifically, it addresses things like it mandates that every agency that utilizes body-worn cameras has to have a policy that talks basically identifies who's going to be wearing them, under what circumstances they'll be used, and how that data will be released. Also provides that those policies have to be publicly available. If the agency maintains a website, it has to be posted on that website. The new law also mandates training, requires officers to be trained, not only in the policies, but in the law. Includes compliance measures so that there's a periodic review that the agencies have to evaluate. They have to look at the practices and make sure that they're complying with the law and the policies that they've made publicly available. And perhaps most importantly, it provides some uniform standards for a retention of the body-worn camera video or the data. And that's something I think will perhaps be of the greatest benefit to law enforcement and to the long-term proliferation of body cameras in Wisconsin.
And when you say the storage of this footage, how long is it required under this new law to store the footage?
Generally, all body-worn camera footage will have to be retained for 120 days. Under certain circumstances, it'll have to be maintained even longer. For example, if it records an encounter that results in physical injury or death, custodial arrest, a search during an authorized temporary questioning, or a law enforcement officer's use of force, that'll have to be retained until the conclusion of an investigation or some litigation or a lawsuit or a complaint.
So it sounds like it really puts a framework for police departments to uniformly use body cameras in their department, that they know what protocols they need to follow. Will that influence more departments to start using them, do you think?
I believe it will. I mean, I've said for a number of years now that and I've spoken with countless officers and chiefs and sheriffs around the state that have indicated to me that they are supportive of body-worn cameras, and they would start a program today. The thing holding them back, however, was they didn't know what the standards for retention were going to be. And if they were going to implement a program and then lawmakers were going to come up with some kind of unreasonable standard that would make it cost prohibitive, that would be a problem. So I think you have a lot of people in the law enforcement community, administrators in particular, that have been following this. And certainly they've been involved in the legislative process just as we have. And just as has a number of diverse groups representing interests, representing the media, open records and transparency advocates, open government advocates, privacy advocates. So this really is a very good piece of public policy that is the result of several years of work on the part of many, and it's a bipartisan piece of legislation as well.
Talking with Jim Palmer, executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, we're looking at the legislation the governor signed last week guaranteeing public access to most police body camera footage. Let's take a call now. Peggy in Madison. Hi, Peggy.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind about this new law?
So I definitely want body cams, but I think they should be open to the family that is involved with the fans, because my daughter had an asthma attack at a private party. She was of age. There was alcohol there, but she had only had a couple drinks. She went into this asthma attack. They called the EMTs. EMT showed up with two police officers. She was fighting to breathe. They cuffed her later on her stomach. She couldn't breathe the entire time. They had three cops with body cams going. The EMT could not get in to help her. She accidentally kicked the police officer when she was fighting, trying to breathe. There were witnesses. $20,000 later, we're in court a year later, and the jury, 10 minutes, it took us a year to get the release of the body cams with a criminal attorney. And then the jury and the judge said, why did this even go to court?
Peggy, thank you for sharing that situation. Peggy saying it took a year to get that footage. What do you hear there in her story?
Well, I think clearly, we've heard this not only from people like Peggy, but from others. There's a clamor. Anytime there's an incident, oftentimes law enforcement encounters can be controversial to one extent or another, and people have a reasonable desire to see the body camera video if it's available. And this new law will provide some parameters for that. And so I think that this is a good development for Peggy and people like her who think, we ought to be able to see what law enforcement officers did and have some resolution.
What are the costs associated with body cameras, and does this legislation address any of those costs?
Yeah, there's a couple things, actually, that the law does not do. It does not mandate that agencies use body cameras. And it also doesn't mandate how they'll be used. That is to say, for example, when an officer turns it on, that kind of thing. Those will still be up to the discretion of the individual law enforcement agency. It also doesn't provide funding. And that is something that perhaps we'll have to consider going forward. But the cameras themselves are, relatively speaking, inexpensive. Obviously, a larger agency, they're going to represent a larger cost. It can be around $1,000 a camera. But, just like with any piece of technology, it soon becomes outdated and needs to be updated.
And then there are the storage costs as well.
And the storage costs are really the most significant aspect of the cost impact of having a body-worn camera program, which is why having, these uniform guidelines as to their retention is so important.
Let's take a moment to look at individual privacy, specifically the privacy of people in their own homes, victims of sexual assault, domestic abuse. What is your response to those who have concerns about privacy issues with body cameras?
Well, as you said in your opening remarks, body camera footage will be generally available under the state's open records law. However, there are some exceptions. For example, if the encounter depicts minors, or if it depicts victims, of sensitive crimes, or if it depicts individuals that have a reasonable expectation of privacy, that is something that the individual law enforcement agencies will have to evaluate under the existing balancing tests under current law to determine whether or not to release that data publicly.
What is the future of police body camera use? I mean, you survey this year after year. Where is it headed?
Yeah, well, we've been doing this, as you mentioned, for 7 years. We're just about to go to do our eighth survey, which we conduct on a wide variety of issues. For five of the last 7 years, we've included questions on body cameras to gauge the public support, and it has consistently grown, and it is overwhelming. Last year, 95% of the public indicated that they support body cameras. And when you ask, a follow-up question about, would you support body cameras if it meant an increase in your local budget? That is to say, possibly an increase in your taxes. There's very little slippage, and it's still, between 80 and 85%, generally speaking. So it's clear the public has a lot of support, maintains a lot of support for body cameras, and I think there's going to be a growing expectation. Just looking at the world in which we live, that when things happen, the public is going to want to know if there was video available. They're going to want to see it if it is available. And if it's not, they're going to want to know why it's not. And I think that's going to place more pressure on law enforcement agencies to adopt these programs.
Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Coming up, the federal government has mandated biosafety precautions for researchers working with coronavirus. A UW-Madison lab got access to dangerous pathogens. We find out what they see under the microscope and how they stay safe. That's in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will be talking about communities that consolidate municipal services and when that makes sense. Do you work for a local or county government? What challenges are you up against in providing public services? Does your municipality share services with a neighboring community? And how is it going? Bring your challenges, your insights right now. We're at 800-642-1234. But first, coronavirus. Congress approved an $8.3 billion emergency aid package headed to the president's desk. So far, 14 deaths have been linked to the virus in the U.S., with more than 200 confirmed cases nationwide. Researchers around the world are racing to learn more about how it works, and these efforts include right here at UW-Madison, which has two teams studying the pathogens that cause COVID-19. Our colleagues at WisconText have reported on how a UW researcher got a hold of a coronavirus sample. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisconText, and he spoke with WPR host Keely Baltina earlier this week.
We've got two big words at play here that might be unfamiliar to people. They were to me. We've got COVID-19, which is a respiratory disease. And then there's SARS-CoV-2, which is actually the pathogen itself that causes the disease. Break that down for us.
Exactly. So SARS-CoV-2 is the name of the actual virus that causes this disease, the virus that emerged in central China the end of last year of 2019. And it causes a disease known as COVID-19, 19 being a reference to 2019.
Okay, so which of the two is UW-Madison then focusing research on?
The researchers at UW-Madison are focusing on the virus itself, so on SARS-CoV-2. Ultimately, they're interested in the disease, but to understand the disease, the researchers have to understand the virus that causes it.
And we have two research efforts then around this particular pathogen at UW-Madison. So what's happening with what Thomas Friedrich and Dave O'Connor are doing?
Those two researchers are collaborating with colleagues at other institutions as well. So they haven't taken receipt of a sample of the virus here in Madison. They're hoping that some of their colleagues at other institutions will be able to. They're going to be researching, hopefully, a whole bunch of things, but they're particularly interested in is how a virus like SARS-CoV-2, which is believed to have originated in an animal species, how a virus like that makes the jump to humans, because there are a plethora of viruses that affect animal species that don't affect humans. And every once in a while, something like SARS-CoV-2 comes around that starts infecting humans and then becomes widely transmissible between humans. And they just want to understand why that is.
Okay, so there's that transition that is one focus of the research. And then there's research from Yoshihiro Kawaoka. Tell us who he is, what he's worked on in the past, where we're going now.
Yeah, Kawaoka is a really pretty prominent researcher at UW-Madison. He's well known for his studies on influenza, really dangerous subtypes of influenza.
Right, a little bit controversial.
Yeah, sometimes they have been, yep. There are some other prominent virologists and scientists who have taken issue with some of his experiments in the past. He's also focused some work on Ebola as well. But he has actually has a sample of the virus that he was able to get from the patient in Dane County, the one confirmed case here in Wisconsin, via UW hospitals where that patient was diagnosed. And he's interested in also a whole bunch of things, but particularly he wants to identify a good animal model for this virus. So he wants to identify a lab animal that exhibits similar symptoms to once infected with this virus as a human would. So that allows for experiments that you could look at a whole bunch of things and kind of use these animal models as a proxy for understanding the infection in humans.
And we should say that the patient with COVID-19 in Wisconsin has recovered, was released from the hospital last week. But on getting the sample, is that way of retrieving the sample and getting it to the lab anyway unusual, or is this how business is done?
It's not necessarily super unusual, but it does involve a whole bunch of hoops to jump through. Regulatory and ethical standards need to be upheld. And it is unusual in the case of SARS-CoV-2 right now, the way that Kouoka was able to get the virus directly from UW hospitals. Most researchers in the nation right now who are studying the virus or hope to study the virus are they have to get a sample of the virus from a contractor for NIH based in Virginia.
And it sounds like those samples are not widely available right now.
No. Based on the website of this contractor, it sounds like labs that want a specimen of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, they're telling them to expect maybe to be able to get two specimens per year per lab at this point, and they're not providing a, like a timeline for when the virus would be widely available or shipped to individual labs.
Right. The phrase "we cannot guarantee" shows up there.
Exactly.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext, and we are talking about research into a novel coronavirus that's happening here at UW-Madison. And Will, this is a dangerous pathogen. We've seen how fast it's spreading and people have died. How do we know that the research happening here in Wisconsin is safe?
That's a really good question. And that was kind of like the meat of that was the main question I wanted to answer in my reporting as well. And there are, I feel assured after talking to a whole bunch of people involved that this research is being conducted really safely. It started out with Dr. Kouoka needed to provide a protocol. He needed to tell UW Hospital what research he intended to do and vouch for the safety practices and the biocontainment, biosafety practices in his lab. He had to assure the hospital that the confidentiality of the patient who was infected with the virus would remain confidential. He had to jump through a whole bunch of hoops in order to even get approval to get a sample of this virus. That approval had to come from the institutional review boards on campus, which make sure that research that involves medical research that involves human subjects, not only medical research, but in this case, medical research, adheres to national and state regulations and high ethical standards. And then on top of that, there's a whole bunch of shipping regulations. Sometimes the people who ship these dangerous pathogens have to be trained and certified. There's regulations from the DOT. Sometimes you have to get special permits to ship viruses such as SARS-CoV-2, even between labs on an individual campus, which was the case here.
It sounds like it is a lot of work, and maybe even some people would call it red tape. But with such a dangerous organism that we're dealing with, I mean, it's really important that this is followed, because otherwise people could get sick.
Yeah, exactly. So the SARS-CoV-2 virus, while it causes mild to moderate symptoms in most people, is really dangerous for a small minority of people and is fatal in some instances. So in cases like that, researchers obviously feel the need to be extra cautious with it, as do the people who house those specimens, hospitals, et cetera.
Right. These medical professionals, these researchers understand the responsibility they have.
Precisely.
And what other takeaways should we bring with us from the reporting that you've done about how UW-Madison is now connected to this global almost pandemic as we're sitting with the WHO here?
I think it's the fact that there was a patient with a confirmed diagnosis in Wisconsin so early on in this outbreak was like a minor moment of like scientific serendipity for these local researchers who suddenly had another place to gain access to this virus and didn't necessarily have to go through the NIH contractor. So it provided when in a case like this, when the race to understand everything we can about this emerging virus is like really urgent, it's really quite fascinating, and I think Wisconsinites should be assured that like the research that's happening here is of a global importance.
And with the global importance and really on the cutting edge of this, do we have any idea when we might start to see some of the findings of the research?
We don't. Yeah. I would assume as soon as possible. But that said, the scientific process, when it's done correctly, takes time. We've already seen Reuters actually did a big look at all of the scientific studies that have come out so far related to the virus. A whole lot of them have not been peer reviewed, and a whole lot of those have had pretty major problems. So science that is conducted correctly takes time and requires that peer review process.
All right. We'll pay attention and check in again. Will, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor at Wiscontext. And he spoke with WPR host Keely Baltina about UW-Madison research on the novel coronavirus. By the way, you can find the story and additional reporting on COVID-19 from our partners at wiscontext.org. Coming up, budgets are tight, and when you and a neighboring municipality need more of the same services like fire, police, snow removal, do you consolidate services or do you go it alone? Wisconsin Policy Forum ran the numbers. Does your municipality share services with a neighboring community? How is it going? Phone lines are open, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's talk about public services and what consolidation could look like in your community. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the pros and cons of local government consolidation is an ongoing debate. Local governments provide many crossover services, police and fire protection, public works, and eliminating some duplication could lower costs. But it's a tricky balance. The Wisconsin Policy Forum did data analysis on what happens when communities combine services, and their new report is a case study on Jefferson County, including these communities. Okay, Watertown, Whitewater, Fort Atkinson, Jefferson, Lake Mills, Waterloo, and Johnson Creek. Do you live in one of these communities? How would you rate the quality of local public services? Would you be in favor of consolidating some services with your neighbor? And if so, what? We're at 800-642-1234. Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. That's a statewide independent policy research organization. And he joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Rob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig into the analysis, what are these communities up against in terms of why they want to merge? What are they facing?
Well, I think some of the common characteristics that we see across communities across the entire state of Wisconsin is two factors. Number one, certainly budget constraints. It's no secret that local government budgets are tight. There are a couple of key factors that are contributing to that circumstance. One is the fact that there are some pretty stringent property tax levy limits on local governments. So they don't have the ability, even if they wanted to go out and potentially raise the revenue they need to meet the service demands of their citizens and so forth. There's also the fact that several local governments are very dependent on state aids, and the state budget has been tight, and so state aids have been stagnant over some period of time. So clearly there's a set of budget constraints, but I would argue that equally important are some human resources challenges facing local governments across Wisconsin. We have a very tight labor market, very low unemployment rates, and particularly when we look at high-skill positions, paramedics and engineers for public works departments and individuals able to do crime analysis for police departments and do GIS and so forth. Those are tough positions to fill. And so to the extent that we see governments facing common human resources challenges, there may be opportunity to try to address some of those challenges together.
Our state is aging as well. What does an aging population mean to the pressure on public services?
Well, that's a great point, and I don't think there's any question that that factor is contributing to a rise in emergency medical services calls across many municipalities. We are seeing that that is the case to some extent in Jefferson County. We've seen it to a greater extent in places like Greater Racine. But clearly, an aging population is demanding more in terms of healthcare services. And fire departments play a critical role in terms of responding, being the first responders to 911 calls. So it's also having an impact on fire services as well.
Well, let's take a call. Ron in Ridgeville is with us. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning, Kate, and good morning to your guest.
Morning.
I guess I'd like to just reflect on what was just said as far as what our challenges are. And we have that here in rural Monroe County as well. I guess my question is, how do we balance? You know, we really value local control, of course. I think most communities do. But also to provide these services and the economic challenges that go with them. People here in rural Monroe County expect to have their roads plowed by the time they go to work. And we've got a lot of miles. In Ridgeville, we've got 39 miles of roads that we need to get through. So how do we balance the kind of local control with providing these services and to do it in a timely manner? And it's just, it really is a challenge. And, consolidating, do you do it by geography? I don't know. It's a real challenge. And I guess, how do we, what are some, ideas on how in a very rural area, I don't know where the study was done, what the population density is, but how do we do it, in a really rural area here?
Yeah, Ron, thanks for sharing your story. Rob, what would be some pointers for him as they look at that, striking that balance between local control and the economics of providing those services?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we emphasize, and we've done several service sharing studies across the state, and we always emphasize that local control is not something to be overlooked. I mean, clearly in an ideal world, local governments are going to want to have that ability to determine how much they are spending and how they are staffing their services to meet their community needs. I think where service sharing really becomes attractive to communities, whether large or small, is that to the extent that there are either technological demands that are requiring potential purchases of expensive equipment, to the extent, again, that there's a rise in emergency medical services calls because of an aging population. The question is whether by combining forces with your neighbor, you're able to achieve a higher level of service than you could otherwise achieve on your own. So if your be-all and end-all is simply to save money, service sharing may not be right for you. Conversely, if what you're really after is you need to find a way to actually enhance your service level, and that's going to be prohibitively expensive, if you try to do it by yourself, exploring opportunities with your neighbors. It could be as simple as sharing a ladder truck, even in dispersed communities. It could be sharing, combining dispatch centers so that a community only has to replace one dispatch console instead of two communities having to make those expenditures separately and so forth. So equipment savings are often really one of the key advantages to the extent that dollar savings are something that you're looking for.
So it sounds like new technology as well can affect a small community's ability to provide quality services.
Absolutely. And not only new technology, but new requirements from other levels of government. So to the extent that the federal government is now requiring dispatch centers, again, as an example, to really upgrade their ability so that they can field emergency calls not only via cell phone and landline, but via text. If the feds say this is something you have to do for several small communities, that's, again, a tough expense to make.
We're talking with Rob Henkin, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He co-authored the recent report that looked at municipal service sharing opportunities in Jefferson County. You can join in. Are you a volunteer firefighter or maybe a part-time EMT? Do you think your area would benefit from sharing these services? Did you move to your community for a local government job? Do you see recruitment issues in your area? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Rob, your recent report looked at Jefferson County. You mentioned dispatch. What benefits did you find when it comes to consolidating fire and dispatch services in Jefferson County?
Sure. So first of all, let me make it clear that this report really took a sort of a 30,000-foot scan. So what we did is we just looked at the fundamental characteristics of the service provision at the municipal level and are suggesting to both municipal leaders and to county government, hey, here are a few areas where we see real potential for further analysis and possible implementation planning. So you are correct that fire and dispatch services were the two that really topped our list. I think for fire, here it's really a human resources challenge, that with the exception of Watertown, the other communities are relying largely on volunteer or paid-on-call or paid-on-premises part-time staffing. And so in this economy, in this labor market, again, filling those positions has become a challenge sort of across the board. And that can be a very serious problem. To the extent that you have to call people in when there is a major incident and you can't find the people to call in, that can obviously have some public safety consequences. So I think for fire, where we saw some real potential was the ability to try to establish sort of more mutual cooperation in terms of how fire services were going to be provided. And again, raising the possibility that instead of having three or four small departments that rely largely on part-time staff, might it make sense to create one larger department that, hypothetically speaking, could rely on full-time staff and address that retention and recruitment issue? The problem, of course, is that if you're relying on full-time staff, then you're not only paying full-time salaries, but you're paying benefits. So then the question is that cost prohibitive to those communities?
What about police and public work services in Jefferson County? What did you find there?
So there we found potential for enhanced service sharing within those functional areas, but we did not see the potential for actual mergers of complete departments. So merging the fire departments for two Jefferson County municipalities was not something that appeared to be practical or necessarily beneficial. That said, there are certain areas within police department functions, and a key one is data collection, synthesis, analysis, where several departments are struggling with maintaining that capability at the level they want. And so the question arose, should you pool your resources and maybe have one or two staff people that you could share that could do that function for all of you? For public works, here we found both human resources challenges and some service level challenges. So human resources challenges was the ability to recruit and retain some of the more technically skilled positions, engineers and so forth. Individual departments worried about losing some of their senior staff and being able to replace them. So the concept arose, well, you know, could we share engineering services? Are there architectural services that we could share, et cetera? Also, lots of discussion about the potential ability to share some expensive equipment. There's certain types of equipment that individual municipal governments feel that they have to purchase for their use, but they're really only using that equipment for a couple of weeks during the year. So that, again, suggests a potential opportunity to share it. The downside there is typically when one community needs it, so will the other community. So you can't share a snowplow because when it snows, you all need that plow.
Well, when you look at Jefferson County and you've done these analyses around the state, do you come to similar conclusions about where you see crossover and when it's good and when it's not?
You know, that's been one of the real interesting parts of doing so many of these analyses and in different types of communities, from smaller villages and more or less densely populated areas to some of the most densely populated areas of the state in Greater Racine, for example, and of course, in Milwaukee County. And I think it really differs. I mean, when we go in, we take a look at a few key factors that sort of are our initial barometers in letting us know just how great the potential might be. We look at whether there's, again, a high cost of new technology that's going to have to be shared, whether there are pending retirements that are going to suggest various personnel issues, whether you can clearly see that there is cost inefficiency in terms of the way services are provided. So there's no clear distinction between whether you're urban or rural, whether you're a large city or a small village. But also one other overriding factor is, do you sort of go into this with a willingness to cooperate with your neighbors?
Stopping right there in just a moment here, Rob Henkin, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, will be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're finding out whether consolidating municipal services actually lowers local government expenditures. It seems plausible that when you share facilities and staffing and technology and other overhead, that will create efficiencies. We're looking at a recent Jefferson County case study from the Wisconsin Policy Forum on what happens when you merge government services and when it does become cost-effective. Do you work for local or county government? What challenges are you facing in your ability to provide public services? Did you move to your community for a local government job? Do you see recruiting issues in your area? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he co-authored its recent report. He stays with us. So, Rob, you've been looking at communities big and small and doing this data analysis. Can consolidation happen on a much smaller scale? Where do you see the nuance?
Again, another very good question. And so we tend to come in and be asked to assist by counties or groups of local governments when they really want to look at some of the more comprehensive service sharing options. And those more comprehensive, of course, the most comprehensive is to actually combine departments. There's a whole real array of options when it comes to service sharing. Some are as basic as I've mentioned, as sharing a piece of equipment, of jointly procuring for either services like healthcare administration or engineering services and so forth. And it sort of then runs across a range of options that are more or less comprehensive. The good news is that communities out there don't need the Wisconsin Policy Forum or don't need to hire for-profit consultants to come in and do analyses when it comes to potentially sharing a position or sharing a piece of equipment or some of those more elementary levels of service sharing. That's something that frankly, we hope will just occur naturally. It's a good practice, as is now occurring in many areas across the state, for groups of local municipal officials within counties, either their administrators or the chief elected officials, to get together on a regular basis and just talk about where there may be opportunities to increase service efficiencies and, again, respond to mutual demands that these communities are facing to enhance services, whether they can cooperate in some way to make that happen in a more efficient fashion.
So when you're running the numbers, you're analyzing the costs and the benefits of services sharing across communities. How do you factor in time? You know, time is money. And if it takes 3 months to merge services or it takes over a year for two departments to be able to merge, is the consolidation still worth it? How does that time impact the success of that merger?
So I think you'd have to look at that on a case-by-case basis. What I can tell you as a resident of Milwaukee County's North Shore, Milwaukee County's North Shore has a consolidated fire department between seven communities. It is widely held up as one of the most successful examples of intergovernmental municipal consolidation, not only in Milwaukee County or the state of Wisconsin, but in the nation. And I can say to you that it took 10 years from when the discussions first started about potentially consolidating those seven fire departments until it actually happened.
10 years.
10 years. Now, does that mean that there were staff spending 40 hours a week analyzing it? No, of course not. But these things can take time, and there are some tough issues. So I think it really depends. But I think in the case of the North Shore, and we did a report back in 2015 where we documented about $2.8 million of annual savings per year for those seven communities combined. So I would imagine that the time spent was worth it.
Sticking to that area, you looked at the potential to share parks and rec services in Racine County. What did you find there?
Yeah, so that was a specific look at the communities in Greater Racine. So it was looking at not only Racine County Parks and Rec Services, but City of Racine and the villages of Caledonia, Mount Pleasant, and Sturtevant. And there we found, going in, we thought that there might be some pretty high potential to have just a unified Greater Racine Parks Department. The fact that you have people working for the city and the villages and the county, they're all maintaining parks within those jurisdictions. In the case of the county, they're maintaining parks within the city city of Racine, yet you also have a city of Racine Parks Department, we thought there might be a real potential to create a single unified department. When we then really dug in, however, we found that there were already lots of efficiencies occurring. The fact that these smaller communities were using workers who were doing both parks and public works and spending more of their time on parks in the summer and public works in the winter made a lot of sense. So instead, we saw some other options. In terms of recreation, there we saw potential to look at least administering recreation programs universally across the communities. In terms of planning for future parks, we saw a lot of potential for enhanced cooperation and collaboration. But I think that's a great example where actual functional consolidation, at least in our eyes, did not seem to be the best answer.
Talking with policy researcher Rob Henkin, who's with us as we explore the potential costs and benefits of shared municipal services, the Wisconsin Policy Forum is out with a new report on those opportunities in Jefferson County. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Curious, Rob, you mentioned that communities really sitting down, talking with each other, having good relationships across boundaries, across municipalities. But you also have to, bear in mind that there's competition. There's competition for residents. There's competition for businesses. You want to build the best amenities that perhaps is maybe even better than your neighbor. How do you account for that?
It's a problem that we often face. And there's also sort of this sense of community pride. For some elected officials, it's important to have the name of that community on the fire truck or the medical unit. And you're right. From an economic development perspective, there is competition. I think one of the things, though, that research has shown is that economic development often is best approached on a more regional level, that having neighboring communities competing at that level, really none of them benefits from that type of a situation instead of, both potentially benefiting. So I think really you sort of have to overcome that. And again, I would emphasize that if you want to look at this because your budget is tight and you need $1 million for something else, that it may not be the right reason to be looking at service sharing. I think the best way to look at cooperating with your neighbors is to say, hey, look, we as a single community can't afford to have the number of paramedics that we would like to have going out on our medical units. We're sending out first responders, but we don't have a paramedic level of care. And we can't afford to get out to that level ourselves. But boy, maybe if we created a joint advanced life support service with two or three of our neighbors, we could really staff that service the way we want. We could pool our resources, and it would be much more affordable for us to do that.
But putting financial savings first at the top of the list may not be the right way to go.
Yep. And again, I say may not. There are cases where, particularly on the capital side, there's some real opportunity for savings there. But it's really cost avoidance. It's, you're not necessarily going to spend less tomorrow than you're spending today if you consolidate services with your neighbor. But you may indeed be spending far less tomorrow than you would otherwise be spending tomorrow if you did not consolidate. So that's really the calculus.
Let's bring in Mike in Chippewa Falls. Quickly. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I'm wondering if the speaker could talk to evaluation metrics after implementation of shared services. How do you determine whether it's poor performance or if it just simply wasn't the right idea for the situation?
Yeah, Mike, great question. What is the postmortem here? What do you look at after you share services?
Yep. Well, so it obviously depends on the service, but let's just use fire as an example and the North Shore Fire Department as an example. We looked at the ISO ratings, which are insurance industry ratings on fire protection, and we found that indeed for those communities, the ISO ratings had improved. You can look at response times when it comes to both fire and EMS, and you can look at costs. I mean, you can do a postmortem that can really show you, hey, here's what we were spending before consolidation, and if we simply adjusted for inflation for 5 years, here's what we would have been spending compared to what we're now spending. And so I think those would be some of the keys for, again, different types of services. There are different metrics that you would want to look at. Public health is an area we haven't touched upon where we have seen some real potential for public health services to be provided over broader geographic areas among multiple communities. That's really the norm now in the state of Wisconsin, but there are still a couple places, and Milwaukee County is the foremost, where there are still individual municipal public health departments. There are indicators like, you know, disease occurrences and measurements of all sorts of health indicators.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate.
Rob Henken is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. And you can find a link to his report. It's called Greater Than the Sum. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's fish fry season. We learn how a yellow perch shortage may affect businesses and restaurants. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.